Well, as we just heard in state news, the results of the April election are in. We will discuss the races of statewide significance this hour. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, April 3rd. We have two legal eagles with us in this half hour who will comment on the reasons behind the win of Supreme Court Justice Pat Rogensack, who defeated her challenger, law professor Ed Falone, in yesterday's election. And we'll have two education watchers with us after 7:30 to discuss the victory of state school superintendent Tony Evers over his challenger, State Representative Don Pridemore. And we will welcome your thoughts and questions for all four of our guests on any of the races at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Let us start with the race for State Supreme Court Justice with our first guest, Rick Essenberg, adjunct professor of law at Marquette University, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. He blogs at Shark and Shepherd, and he is a frequent op-ed writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why did Justice Rogensack defeat law professor Ed Falone?
Well, the first thing you have to keep in mind is that it is almost unheard of for a justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court who has been elected in the past, as opposed to merely appointed, to be defeated for re-election. It's happened twice in the 160-year history of the court. The first time was a justice who had enforced the Fugitive Slave Act was defeated for re-election. The Fugitive Slave Act wasn't too popular in Wisconsin prior to the Civil War. And the second was a justice who had cast the fourth vote to in a decision which allowed the Milwaukee Braves to move to Atlanta. So the bar for re-election, isn't particularly high. I think that when you combine that with the fact that there was never a really sound rationale for the challenge, essentially the theme that the Falone campaign chose was to blame Pat Rogensack for the altercation between two other justices, an altercation that she, in fact, broke up, and to sort of make her the face for the discord in the court. But there was never any plausible argument that she was responsible for that discord on the court. The campaign theme didn't track. It never got any, it never got much public support. He never attracted any money to his campaign, and I think it was pretty obvious from the get go that this challenge just wasn't going to go anywhere.
Yeah. How important was it that he was not a judge?
Well, I'm of two minds about that. First of all, I think as an argument, the public probably places too much emphasis on that, because being a justice of the Supreme Court is very different than being a circuit court judge. And there have been a number of justices on our court. On our current court, the Chief Justice Abrahamson, was never a judge before she became a Supreme Court justice. Justice Prosser was never a judge before he became a Supreme Court justice. And so, as somebody who watches and studies the court, I think that argument is oversold. On the other hand, it does have a certain resonance with the public. And, as a campaign theme, I think it has some power.
Why is it so hard to beat an incumbent Supreme Court justice?
Well, there are a lot of people who feel that, unless a judge does something wrong, that they should be reelected. Right? First of all, I think in Wisconsin we tend to reelect incumbents here to begin with. We've got people who have held Senate seats and congressional seats for a very long period of time. That seems to be even more so with judicial candidates, because the races don't don't attract a great deal of interest. It's really hard to frame the issues in a way that engages the public attention. And so the advantage of incumbency, I think, is even stronger than it otherwise would be in those races.
Yeah.
Plus, you can't. It's really hard to raise money, and you know, challengers generally, you know, are going to be less known, and you know, need to have resources to get the name out there.
Yeah. So Justice Rogensack had a lot more money, had a lot more support, other different third party groups in running ads for her.
Right. I mean, I think that the question for observers in this election is, was this going to become like the Kloppenburg-Prosser race? Because there was at least some possibility early on that opponents of Act 10 would sort of see this as their last opportunity to defeat the law. That perhaps if you could change the composition of the court, there would be some possibility to sustain, you know, at the Supreme Court level, which is where it has to be sustained, a constitutional challenge to the law. But that never happened. I think that, so the word around is that, you know, there was just not a willingness to invest more money into the issue. There wasn't the belief that that the investment would produce results, and so it never happened.
So do you think voters were sending a message one way or the other in terms of Act 10 when they cast their votes?
No, because I don't think in this race that you can say that. The turnout was very, very low. It was sort of along the lines that we usually see for a state Supreme Court. A court race, you know, somewhere in the 800,000, a little bit more than 800,000. I just think that in this case, you had an incumbent justice who is widely perceived to, you know, be doing a good job. I think that the narrative that she was somehow responsible for discord on the court never tracked, never scanned. It shouldn't have scanned. It was false. I mean, it's a fundamentally false narrative, given the normal dynamics for a race like this, she was always, I think, headed for a relatively easy victory.
Joy Cardine talking with Rick Essenberg, an adjunct professor of law at Marquette University, talking about yesterday's election results, in particular the state Supreme Court race that had Justice Pat Rogensack defeating her challenger, law professor Ed Falone. Welcoming your questions or your reaction at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Coming up in just about 5 minutes or so, we'll get another perspective on this particular race from former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, Peg Lautenschlager. There were a few other races on the ballot that I wanted to run by you, Rick Essenberg, including the... maybe we can just do this in general. There were a number of states' circuit court judge races that were on the ballot that involved judicial appointees of Governor Scott Walker. It appears it was a mixed night for those?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you had I think, three circuit court races that I'm aware of where the governor and the recall sort of became a salient issue. You had two Walker appointees running, one in Milwaukee and one in Dane County. In Dane County, the Walker appointee, Rebecca St. John, was defeated. In Milwaukee County, the Walker appointee, Rebecca Bradley, was successful in staving off a challenge. You also had a race in the suburbs in Milwaukee, in Ozaukee County, in which a three-term incumbent judge was challenged, and the principal issue was that he had signed a recall petition, and he was defeated quite handily by his challenger. So, you know, what you make of that, I think it's hard to say. I think it underscores the fact that Act 10 and, you know, Governor Walker are not particularly popular in Dane County, and perhaps not sufficiently unpopular in Milwaukee County to preclude the reelection of a Walker appointee who, you know, had a fairly strong conservative and Republican background, and that, you know, signing the recall petition in Ozaukee County is not particularly popular, either because the recall is not particularly popular or because people don't think that judges should sign recall petitions.
Any surprise that there was a big yes vote to continue same-day voter registration with this advisory referendum question on the ballot in Milwaukee?
No, not really. I mean, I think that was really sort of an effort to bump up the turnout in Milwaukee County. I don't know if it had that impact or not, because I haven't gone back and looked at the numbers, but I think, you know, everybody knew that people would turn out and vote yes on that, and I think that perhaps the thinking was that maybe that issue would energize voters more than judicial races and the race for state, you know, superintendent.
Let me take one quick call for you, Dan in Franksville. Hello, Dan.
What was the ratio on the Supreme Court thing first on the race there, on the money spent?
The money spent. I don't have that handy.
How many to one? Oh. Well, I mean, to me, I just, you know, when I first heard way back that Supreme Court justices were being bought, you know, where they actually money, and so, you know, that people would put money forward for a Supreme Court. I mean, just on the face of it, it sounds terrible as far as democracy. And, as far as it goes, I mean, if she had that much, if she was spending 8-1, I mean, if I'm going to have a boxing fight, you know, is that fair?
Yeah. So was it 8-1? Do you know, Rick Hessenberg?
You know, I don't know what the numbers were. I think that the money that was spent on this Supreme Court race is substantially less than the amount of money that was spent on races in the past. Both of them were up on television. I don't think both of them were up on television a lot. I would guess that the spending was a fraction of what we've seen recently in the court races. And, you know, whether it was 8-1, 2-1, 3-1, or even, I just don't think that there was ever any possibility that she was going to lose this unless you could make the race salient, like the Kloppenburg-Prosser race was, and really turn it into a referendum on something else that people cared more about. And the ironic thing, given the caller's comments, is that the only way that was ever going to happen is that if there was a lot of money spent on behalf of the challenger, as there was on behalf of Joanne Kloppenburg. But I think that, you know, rational political actors decided that they weren't going to spend the money this time around because you know, they didn't think that it would be a why. They didn't think that it would win. I question the notion that the fact that people spend money in politics means that they're buying judges, that they're buying politicians. I mean, if you really look at the research, people tend to attract, people take positions first and then attract financing. Now, you know, you can make arguments that, you know, well, perhaps we shouldn't do that because people who can attract more money have an advantage. But I think that sort of the facile assumption that people are being bought or influenced by the expenditure of money is one that we sometimes hear made too easily.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Rick Hessenberg, adjunct professor of law at Marquette University. We'll hear from Peg Lautenschlager coming up in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's going to be a sunny, mild day today with highs in the low to mid 40s. We are getting reaction and analysis to yesterday's election results, spending this half hour talking about primarily the win of Supreme Court Justice Pat Rogensack over her challenger, law professor Ed Filone. We now hear from another guest on this race. Peg Lautenschlager is a former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, former state lawmaker, and former United States attorney. She's currently attorney at the Bauer and Bach law firm. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today, Joy?
I'm all right, Peg. So what's your analysis here? What happened? Why did Justice Rogensack defeat Ed Filone?
Well, I think that there were two factors involved in the race. Number one, I think, is that there's always an advantage to an incumbent, and Justice Rogensack has very effective ads that ran not necessarily through her campaign, but through the Club for Growth and other conservative organizations, which determined that they would put money into this race, and they did, particularly here in the Fox Valley, where I live. You saw on Green Bay TV quite a few Rogan Sack ads, obviously trying to drive up the Republican vote in areas that traditionally have been conservative, and do so for Rogan Sack. I think the second issue is simply that the message in terms of the dysfunction of the court, which was one that was emphasized by Ed Falone, is one where I think the ordinary citizen doesn't necessarily get it. They maybe remember something, you know, the allegations with Justice Pross or the choking event, that sort of thing, but they don't necessarily understand how that ties in with the overall dysfunction that our Supreme Court has seen. And because groups like the Greater Wisconsin Committee, which ordinarily support more progressive candidates, decided to sit this race out, I don't think there were the resources available to really get that message to the public in a short period of time.
Let me take a quick call for you, Andrea in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to correct what I think is a mischaracterization in the previous segment that relates to what Peg just said. Partly from your show, Joy, what I picked up about the argument against Rogan Sack was that, not that she caused the discord, not that she was responsible for Prosser choking the other justice, but that she prevented him from being held accountable, that by declaring herself a witness and recusing herself from, I think, an ethics assessment, nothing could be done because the Supreme Court had to do it, and she prevented the Supreme Court from doing it.
Yeah. So, Peg, that's...
I don't disagree with Andrea. Mm-hmm. I think that's very true, but I think part of the problem is that while there are many of your listeners who are very aware of those kinds of things, I think the general public isn't necessarily sensitive to those issues, and I think that's where the disconnect came. Sometimes... You know, unfortunately, I think political races, whether they be judicial or legislative or somebody serving in an executive branch function, those races oftentimes are reduced to kind of the 60-second, probably the 30-second ad these days, not even the 60-second ad, that they're reduced to the general public sort of knowing one thing about a particular race. And while I think there were things that could be said, a case could be made that indeed Justice Rogan Sack has played a key role in the court's dysfunction. Getting there from the general public impression that, geez, why did Justice Prosser try to choke Justice Bradley, was sort of a big jump that many voters and many people who aren't court watchers or keen listeners to sophisticated news shows necessarily grasped. And so I think that was problematic. And that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that there isn't a logic that can be applied that make her accountable. I'm just saying that I'm not sure that was something that was grasped by the average voter.
Let's go to Nate in Milwaukee now. Hi, Nate.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I think there were a couple themes now granted, he had an uphill fight, just because of incumbency money and all that. But I never heard until this week that the first time Mrs. Rogan Sack ran for the Supreme Court, that she actually ran with absolutely no experience. And just sort of throwing that out.
She was an appeals court judge. But anyway.
She was appeals court judge, I believe, after she lost in a race for the state Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. But anyway, what was your point that you wanted to make a point about the Ozaukee County judicial race?
Sure. I actually mentioned both of those. The Ozaukee judicial race is important because the guy who lost not only was a veteran judge, but he was recognized as one of the best judges in the state. So I thought that was an important race to look at because it was utterly political. It's not experience based. It's not quality of the person race. And I think one of the challengers had even been asked if you can point to a decision this person made that you really can disagree with. And the guy didn't have much to say. So this was totally politically based. Plus,
yeah,
it reminds people that, or might serve as a reminder, that part of the effort to look through all the names wasn't just to verify that the recall effort was valid, but actually can be used and has been very publicly used in this situation.
Now, let me get Peg to very briefly comment on those comments, Peg, as we're coming up on a news break.
Yeah, I agree with the caller that it's interesting to watch when incumbents tout their experience. Many of them at least have not had experience when they first ran, but then once they become incumbents, they have the experience. And I think that's something we see in elections every day. As to the Ozaukee County vote, and I know Rick had talked about it earlier in your show, what was interesting to me was the way in which, particularly if you compare the Ozaukee race with the Dane County race, I think it's evident of the polarization of this state in terms of what has happened since Act 10. You see a county like Dane really, really supporting, or, you know, really dumping somebody out, a moderate judge who's got a good record, but yet because she was appointed by Walker, et cetera, they dump her out, whereas in Ozaukee County, a Republican judge appointed by Tommy Thompson, supported by the Republican DA, recognized as a good judge, gets dumped out because he supported the recall petition. So I think it shows how extreme the sides have become in terms of being divided.
Yeah, we have just a minute to go. Any last thoughts on the election results?
Well, I think, you look at the way things played out, and unfortunately what it shows is that there are powerful people who decide whether or not elections can be won or lost and determine whether or not resources should be put into those elections. In our state Supreme Court race, you saw that Club for Growth thought that indeed Rogan Sack could be a winner. A lot of resources were put in to drive up conservative votes, even to there was an ad talking about Ed Falone in a disparaging way involving gangs. It was crazy. But they put in that money. The more progressive groups decided, no, there wasn't going to be an opportunity to win here, so they saved their money for something else. I think that kind of thing is kind of sad because it leaves the voters in the lurch.
Thank you, Peg, for being with us.
Thank you.
Peg Lautenschlager, former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin. We'll check news, and then we will talk about the results in the race for State Superintendent of Public Instruction. State School Superintendent Tony Evers defeated his challenger, Republican State Representative Don Pridemore, in yesterday's spring election. We will hear from two guests with different views on education issues on the election results this hour. And we hope you weigh in with your questions and your views, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 7:37 on this Wednesday, April 3rd. We will start this round of election results reaction with Mary Bell, President of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, or WEAC. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's your reaction to Tony Evers defeating Don Pridemore?
Well, we think it was a really important election, and I'm very personally pleased because it's clear that the voters of Wisconsin understand how qualified and that Tony Evers was, in fact, the best candidate to continue serving as state superintendent, that his balanced approach, which, you know, in our organization does not demand that anyone be constantly agreeing with every position that we take, but in fact seeks a balance that's in the best interests of Wisconsin's students and public schools.
The Superintendent Evers said that his reelection affirms that voters are committed to a strong public school system. Do you think so?
That is clearly true, because the one thing that Superintendent Evers was able to do in this election from the beginning was state positions on what he stands for in this office. And that's something that we don't always hear from candidates, but it was very clear that he was for a fair funding proposal that gives public schools the resources that they need, and that he took a clear stand against non-taxpayer accountable private schools getting public school money. And that kind of expansion and exactly what's going on right now in the state budget and that will come to the legislature really reflects the battle that we have in this state about making sure that public schools receive public taxpayer dollars and that non-accountable schools have a place in our system. But it is not to be funded by the public taxpayer dollars, especially when resources are as tight as they have been. And we really need to make sure that all students are served by the public schools first.
The challenger, Republican State Representative Don Pridemore, did favor the expansion, the proposed expansion of the school voucher program or the private school choice program. What's wrong with that, Mary Bell?
Well, the issue really is that we need to be sure that our public schools are funded. You can't decide that you're going to freeze public school funding and yet put millions more dollars into an unaccountable private school. People understand that diverts the very resources their local public schools need. And if you look across the state, people say they know and they are voting for and they pay attention to what happens in their public schools. They value those as community resources, and they want to be sure that those dollars are spent in a way that's accountable to those local taxpayers.
And why do you say it's not being spent? Why are they non-accountable?
Well, because the voucher schools or those public-funded voucher programs are given to school district schools that are not controlled by local school boards, that are not part of a regular election process, and that do not have to answer to the same kinds of accountability measures that every public school in this state has to do.
Mm-hmm. When you say that funding for public schools has been frozen, why do you say that? We heard Governor Walker say that he was increasing it by about 1%.
Well, just like everything else that deals with how dollars are spent, it can be manipulated in a number of different ways. But the money that Governor Walker has put into this budget for public schools, real public schools, accountable public schools, is money that goes right past the schoolhouse door and into a levy property tax credit. It is money to schools, but it never goes to the resources that schools are allowed because it's under a revenue limit that doesn't allow them to spend those monies, so they go to property tax relief. That doesn't allow us to build the kind of programs that our students need for the next century. Our schools are, in many cases, losing program, losing educators, raising class sizes, because they don't have the resources they need to respond to the kind of change that is coming to all of our schools in the next few years.
So now that Tony Evers will be serving another term, what is your hope for public education in Wisconsin?
Well, I really hope that we can get past the distractions of trying to find a quick fix or trying to find a fix that doesn't really involve educators and that doesn't really involve the schools in which they work. Because if you don't pay attention to those basic fundamentals, the system can't be implemented. I think what Superintendent Evers has shown is that he is willing to work with people with varying perspectives on how those things happen, but that his commitment and the commitment of the state of Wisconsin is that students from everywhere have access to a quality public school where they live.
We are talking with Mary Bell. She is president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council. We're getting her take on yesterday's election results, which found State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tony Evers, winning another term. He defeated his challenger, State Representative Don Pridemore. We're welcoming your reaction to that election at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You can also talk to us about the issues in public education that matter most to you as well. How important is it, Mary Bell, that the post of State Superintendent of Public Instruction when it comes to things like a proposed expansion of the private school voucher program?
I think it's, well, I am very, very pleased that Wisconsin has an independently elected state superintendent. It means that people have a chance to focus on the issue of education when they make that vote, and that they have a chance to weigh the issues, because education in Wisconsin is a public trust. What this vote says, and it was a larger margin of victory, as I read it, than Justice Rogensack received from your last half hour. What it says is that focused on the very issues that are central to education, the public in Wisconsin has said they want their local public schools to receive resources, not in a throw money at it way, but in a very targeted funding program that Superintendent Evers has been trying to get public attention to for a number of years. Mm-hmm. He really has, at this point, an election result that is based on the very issues that are central to funding and then making accountable those local public schools.
Jerry on Facebook writes, "I am so relieved that Evers won. No one should head an education department if they have never taught a day in their life." Is that right, that State Representative Pridemore didn't teach ever?
I believe that's true. What concerned me even more than experience, although I think it matters a great deal in terms of credibility and really an understanding of the implementation of a number of issues, are the positions that he took on education issues, that they really lacked a commitment to the tradition of Wisconsin's public schools and to the tradition that local school boards who are elected and members of their own communities really make reasoned judgments about what a community can afford and about what a community needs to do in order to invest in itself and its children for the future of that community. When you get to private school vouchers, they are not accountable to those taxpayers for how the money is spent. And that is a real break from, I think, what Wisconsin's commitments to their children are.
Scott in DeForest is with us. Hello, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your thought here?
Yeah, you know, there's been a lot of talk about accountability. And as a parent of an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, the number one person who the school should be accountable to is the parent. And I believe the parents know what's in the best interest of their child more so than the state and or a local board or a union. We have been able to enroll our kids in a private school, which is a good thing for our kid. We can make that decision. We pay taxes. What is wrong with me taking my tax dollars that I pay and applying it to the school of my choice, which I think is in the best interest of my child?
Mary Bell?
Because the tax dollars don't just come from you. The tax dollars don't just come from parents. The tax dollars come from the citizens of the community. And those communities need to be involved in what those schools do and how they are accountable to parents as well as to the larger community. It really is an investment that we all make as citizens of the state of Wisconsin in our future. And it's been a strength. There will always be, and there should always be, private options for people, but those options should not involve my tax dollars as well being used in a way that is not accountable to me as a taxpayer.
Next, we go to Kevin in Madison. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I didn't get a chance to check the results on various school district referenda from yesterday's election, but around the state, I was wondering if you could comment on any trends that you're seeing in terms of referenda from school districts for to exceed revenue limits for funding capital projects or operating and maintenance, and how the state-imposed revenue limits and the governor's current budget for education are affecting trends on school district referenda.
Well, thanks, Kevin. I'm sorry, I don't have anything at my fingertips. Mary Bell, were there any messages sent there?
I don't have complete results. The ones that I've been watching clearly indicate. What we know, number one, is that there were a number of referenda around the state because school districts are increasingly unable to meet regular maintenance under the budget, and they're anticipating
if the budget restrictions that they're under become worse with level funding from the state in the next biennium, that those needs are going to increase. So there are a number of them that have come out. It is exceedingly difficult in tough economic times for local communities to pass referenda. The ones that pass, I think, are a real credit to those communities because they've said, yeah, it may be tough times, but this is important to us and we're going to pass it. Where they fail, I think it's a reflection that the communities just feel they cannot do that anymore. And that's a sad thing for those districts and for the children that attend them. But we do what we can, and that school districts need to consistently go to referenda for that kind of support is a distraction from the real business of trying to educate those kids. And I think that's unfortunate that so many have to do that.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Mary Bell is president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, or WEAC, reacting to the results in yesterday's spring election that found State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers defeating his Republican challenger, State Representative Don Pridemore. We'll get another perspective on this in just a moment. We'll be talking with the president of School Choice Wisconsin. And you can continue to react at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Checking the weather forecast for today, it's going to be mostly sunny and mild. We can expect highs mainly in the low to mid-40s. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In this big question segment, we are reviewing yesterday's spring election results. Why did State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers defeat his challenger, State Representative Don Pridemore? And what message did that race send? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We just heard from Mary Bell, the president of WEAC. Now let's hear from another guest, Jim Bender, president of School Choice Wisconsin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Your reaction to the DPI superintendent election results?
Well, I thought it was an interesting race, but I would probably not draw anywhere near the same conclusions that Mary Bell did. I think Don Pridemore had a tough hill to climb in this race, having not an education background. I think, you know, clearly he's worked on education issues in the legislature and is well-versed in a lot of the education issues that face Wisconsin. But without, you know, that education pedigree on a race where there was little or no advertising, there was, you know, it was very much under the radar. I think it's pretty tough to draw conclusions off the stances that each person took on a low turnout election. So, I think it was a bit predictable. These are very, you know, difficult races to win, and normally the person that comes out of the education establishment is the one that wins it. That's certainly been the trend the last, you know, few decades in Wisconsin.
Yeah, so you don't think this was any sort of a message being sent that the people of Wisconsin do not want an expansion of school choice or school vouchers?
No, if I thought Tony Evers had run his campaign on that, maybe that'd be one thing. Clearly he's taken a stance on it, but this was not a referendum on what would happen with the voucher program. The latest polls that came out, either the Marquette poll or the Public Opinion Strategies poll that came out about a month ago, both showed a majority of people want to see not only statewide, but even some targeted expansion of the choice program. So it's very difficult to say that, you know, one low turnout election is a referendum on what should happen. I mean, in that sense, I guess Mary Bell would have to say that the recall petition, you know, the recall election with Scott Walker means that collective bargaining is a settled issue and should never be brought up in a future legislature. I doubt she's going to be willing, you know, to go that far on the Walker recall, but she's conveniently trying to do that to a low turnout election here on the Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Why, Jim Bender, is it a good idea to expand the school voucher program?
Well, and I'll pick off some words that Mary Bell said. I mean, she said that the schools are unaccountable because there's not a district administrator, there's not an elected school board, there's not these layers of bureaucracy overseeing the schools, and therefore they're not accountable. The the simple fact is what she's missing is that they're accountable to parents. Nobody is required to go to a private school. The, you know, students, as the Supreme Court has ruled, are not mere creatures of the state. These are, this is not just a simple formula where all students and all funding are required to stay in a public monopoly. That's not what the Wisconsin Supreme Court has ruled, not what the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled. And I would just say this, and Green Bay comes to mind because it's the one I'm most familiar with talking about expansion of vouchers. When you're talking about accountability, I would say this. You look at a graduating class last year in Green Bay of 1,500 kids. 1,000 of them were white. The rest were Native American, African American, and Hispanic, about 500 in total. If you take the low-income and minority graduation rates out of that graduating class, it hovered right at about 60%. African Americans only graduated at a rate of 50% last year. Now, there's a school board in place, there's a district administrator, there's a business administrator, there's all sorts of layers of bureaucracy and accountability in Green Bay, yet only 60% of their low-income kids are graduating. That means that hundreds of kids are leaving that graduating class without a high school diploma every year, and that's been happening for multiple years. So this idea that accountability issues guarantees is just false. And so the idea that only public dollars can be put and exclusively into a public school system, and that's the way that the Constitution set it up, is just a false nomer, because there's two parts of that. Common schools have to be guaranteeing some level of outcome, and that is not being met right now in a number of areas around the state. And I would argue that if 40% of your low-income kids aren't graduating, you're not holding up your constitutional end to the bargain. What we say is, parents will be the best arbiter of where that child will have the most chance for success. They will find the best school for their child. And when you insert parental control into the current education establishment, I understand why the education establishment gets a little freaked out. You're changing the status quo. They lose control. They don't have a vertical control from top to bottom of those dollars, and they start to get a little nervous. And they should, because when parents are given the ability to move their child, and they're the ones that are directing those dollars, which will guarantee more success, that's when the education establishment gets, you know, very nervous.
Let's get a quick call in for you. Charles in Mount Zion, what's your point?
Pardon me.
We're almost out of time, Charles. What was your reaction to the election result?
Well, I don't really care all that much about the election. I had a slight preference for Evert. But my point is that, in order to live in a decent society, everybody's children have to be educated. So I think that even people who can't afford private schools for their children should be happy to pay school taxes and even more school taxes. I don't have children. I never did have children. I never will have children. But this is the one tax that I'm happy to pay.
All right. Thank you, Charles. Because we only have a minute or so to go, Jim Bender, critics of expanding the voucher program say that the voucher schools are not doing a whole lot better in educating kids than the public schools, that they're, you know, that the research is still unsettled on that. What is your reaction?
Nothing could be further from the truth. What they do is they try to selectively take 1 year of test data and try to make a comparison between one group of kids and another group of kids, which, of course, flies in the face of what they're also saying about the report card, that it's not ready to be used. The report card uses multiple years of data and, you know, many factors to reach their conclusions. The statutorily mandated school choice demonstration project covered a matched set of students in MPS and the voucher program in Milwaukee over 5 years. And they came up with very solid conclusions that the parental choice program not only had measurable statistical increases in attainment, but they had significantly higher graduation rates, significantly higher college acceptance rates, and significantly higher college retention rates. This means the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program is graduating more students, getting them in college. Those students are staying in college at roughly half the cost of traditional public schools.
And we have to leave it there. Jim Bender, president of School Choice Wisconsin, thank you for being with us. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.